Hey there, it's me, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, that redheaded actor from Modern Family. I have a podcast. It's combining a couple of my favorite things, talking and food. Please join me as I dine with the biggest names in entertainment. People like Julie Bowen, Kristen Bell, Fred Armisen, and so many more. It's called Dinners on Me, and you're invited. Am I saying a chocolate souffle is going to get me to reveal all of my secrets? Yeah, I am. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Capehart. Conventional wisdom, and a healthy helping of gerrymandering, says the upcoming midterm elections are supposed to be a boon for Republicans. The Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade has upended that conventional wisdom, but my guest argues that that conventional wisdom ignores a major factor, race. Steve Phillips first came to the podcast in 2018 with his New York Times bestselling book, Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. Today, he's out with a new book, How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. As Phillips explains in this conversation first recorded for Washington Post Live on September 26th, the Confederates never stopped fighting. And Phillips explains what progressives need to do to win that fight.
All right, before we dive deep into the book, let's just start at the 35,000-foot level. You argue that race is more central to politics today than ever before. Why?
So the country's undergone a demographic revolution in that the country used to be 12% people of color in 1965 and is 40% today. So that has revolutionary implications for how politics is conducted, for electoral outcomes, for electoral strategy and results. And so historically, politics in this country has been a contest among white people. And so you had liberal whites competing with conservative whites to try to get the whites in the middle. And that's how politics functioned for centuries. And up until 65, when the Voting Rights Act was passed and the Immigration Reform Act was passed under LBJ. And that transformed both the composition of the country and the composition of the electorate. And so now people of color are of a sizable enough population that people of color aligned with that liberal progressive white population are a majority of the people. And that's what I laid out in my first book, Brown is the New White. The election of a black president, the re-election of a black president, the vast majority of people of color, the meaningful minority of whites who are progressive was 51% in 2016 and is growing today. But too few people look at elections through that lens. They still think it's a contest among white people. They discount the salience and significance of people of color in politics, despite the dramatic statistical relevance. Nearly 90% of black people vote Democratic compared to 44% of whites. And that's a pretty strong data point, but does not get looked at by most people within politics.
Okay, there are a couple of things I want to touch on from your answer. One, your book, Brown is the New White, as you well know, but also folks who have been reading me since then know that that book became a Bible for me after it came out because of the argument you were making. But the second part that I want to touch on in your response there is the demographic changes in the country. One big mantra to come out of certainly the 2016 election, but also in elections since then, is that demography isn't destiny. So talk to people who think that simply because the nation is getting browner and blacker, that automatically means that progressive candidates or Democratic candidates are going to win elections.
Well, fundamentally, it's a question of turnout. And so it's funny because people say this thing a lot about, you know, demography isn't destiny and it's not, it can happen automatically. And I'm like, who actually says that and thinks that? I spend most of my time trying to argue with Democrats and progressives to see the significance of demography and to invest in it in a significant way. Joe Biden said on election night 2016, says, we're ahead in Georgia. That's not one we expected. And the reason he didn't expect it because they didn't invest. And so if you don't invest in the demographic revolution, then it's not going to bring about electoral outcomes. But it's a very incontrovertible data point that people of color are overwhelmingly progressive in terms of how they vote. I said 90% of African Americans every election since 1976, when they started tracking this in exit polls, roughly 2/3 of all people of color, sometimes up to 3/4, vote Democratic and progressive, and which is not surprising in a country where the other party is predicated upon white racial resentment. So it really shouldn't be shocking people. But the failure to understand and invest and lean into and lift up the leaders and move resources to the groups trying to get people of color to the polls will result in the demography not transforming elections. But where you do that, as Stacey Abrams and Raphael Warnock and New Georgia Project and others did in Georgia, you will win a state that the president-elect did not think he was going to win, and you will transform the entire United States Senate by winning those two Senate seats if you invest. And that's a fundamental argument that I've been trying to make these past several years.
Right, and it's that investment, because I was here scribbling myself a note, because you know, you make the point that overwhelmingly African-American voters and people of color will vote for progressive candidates. But then it becomes an issue of, well, sure, 90% of 1,000 people voting is big, but in some elections, it's 90% of 100 people voting in an election. So is it the investment in reaching out to those communities? Is that what makes the difference between 90 out of 100 versus 90 out of 1,000 showing up to vote on election day?
Right. It's a combination of the dollars that go to the groups who are doing the voter mobilization work. And that in my new book, I lift up case studies of examples of groups who are doing the day-to-day nitty-gritty work of getting people of color to surmount the obstacles that are put in their way to actually cast ballots. So that's a part of it. Then there's also a question of having candidates who inspire and connect with and resonate with the constituency and the community that move people to actually turn out. And that's a lot of what you saw in 2018 with Stacey Abrams' dramatic voter turnout increase, which you saw with Obama. And it's also public policies, to the extent that you're going to fight for issues that the community cares about. And that's what I was actually quite pleasantly surprised to see about the Biden administration. Part of what moved them on the student debt relief is that they were actually saying, we have to offer something to young people and people of color to motivate them to see the significance of what we're actually doing. So it's all three of those, the money, the message to the policy, and then the people who we actually put forward as the leaders. That combination is what has historically produced the largest turnout that then results in winning elections.
So I can imagine that some people listening to this conversation, particularly Black voters, are probably thinking, yeah, well, turnout is one thing, but you've got all these voter restrictions out there and all these efforts to keep us from voting. Can Black voters, can progressive organizations out-organize efforts to suppress the vote?
Well, I mean, that's been the 157-year challenge, right? I mean, after the end of the Civil War, this is why I lay out in my new book, I talk about this Confederate battle plan that is very consistent, and part of it is ruthlessly rewriting the laws to prevent people from participating. The majority of people in South Carolina and Mississippi after the Civil War were Black. So, of course, they certainly could not have them vote. And so you had all of these things get created, grandfather clauses and all these different manipulations to keep people from voting. But that's been the history of this country ever since then, fighting against that work. Martin Luther King said, give us the ballot, we will transform the South. Jesse Jackson's campaigns came out of that effort, doubled the turnout of people of color. So it's an ongoing fundamental struggle, which would be better served if the people at the top level of the party and the people who spend the most money would invest in the groups and the people and the leaders and the work required to get people to overcome those obstacles.
I'm sitting here struggling where to go next in the questioning, because there's so much here between the book and your new majority index. So let's go to the new majority index, Steve. This is an index that you've developed. And I'm wondering, how does it differ from other indices like the Cook Political Report or Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball, where, you know, those are the two the two reports that people look at when they're trying to decide, you know, which races are the ones to watch or which way, you know, the midterm elections are going to go. Your index actually is, well, one, talk about it, and then I'll ask you my follow-up question.
So it goes to what I was saying originally, that people have historically seen politics as a contest between white people. And so they have not focused on people of color. And so, again, from a simply a statistical standpoint, to be able to look at elections and not take race into account means that at a given, your analysis is thinner and less elaborate and less comprehensive. So Cook's report is good in terms of looking at presidential past results. They look at a congressional district. How did the Democrat and Republican do in that congressional district? And how does that compare to the national average? And that gives you some sense of the relative partisan lean of that district. So that's useful. 538, for example, they just use polling data. And that's largely the essence of what their analysis is. But neither of them look at racial data. And so that's what we do. Is we take the same data that Cook looks at in terms of presidential results. We add in racial data. What is the racial diversity of that district? And then what is the difference in voter turnout by racial group? And in almost all of the districts, whites vote at a higher level than people of color. Lots of reasons for that. But the failure to account for that when people of color are so overwhelmingly Democratic in their voting preference leads your analysis to be less rigorous and less elaborate. And so that's the contribution that we've made, is to build upon the same data set that Cook has used and add in a richer, fuller, more robust data set by looking at the racial demographics and then the racial participation rates by each racial group.
So then, given what you just said, it seemed like everybody was surprised by the results out of the election in the 19th Congressional District of New York. Given the new majority index, would you have been surprised by the result?
No. I mean, that's an interesting district, and it's interesting because it's also not fully reflected. It's also quite interesting because, you know, Antonio Delgado represented an African-American man in an almost 90% white district. And so you already had a very interesting dynamic going on there in terms of a black candidate doing better. But that's the other overarching piece around this, around the midterm elections, right? Even after redistricting, all the ways that the seats have been carved up, Biden won the most votes in 226 of these seats. And so 218 is what you need for a majority. So then it becomes a question of turnout. And that's what gets lost in a lot of this analysis as well. People think that it's the same voters and they're just flipping back and forth based upon inflation rates in the stock market and whatnot. But that's not what happens. It's a question of turnout. And so the New York 19 seat is a Biden seat. And so if those voters were to come back out in larger numbers, then it shouldn't be surprising at all. But that's, I think, the other aspect. We're looking at race, but we're also looking at turnout, which is a very missing element of electoral analysis.
Right, turnout. Everything comes back to turnout. I do want to talk about issues and how that impacts turnout, how that impacts enthusiasm. The latest Washington Post poll shows that 56% of registered voters surveyed trusted Republicans on the issue of crime, and that's the highest of all the issues listed. Meanwhile, there's a front page story in the Washington Post today, on how Republicans are increasingly centering their pitch to voters on crime, which has prompted accusations of racism from many Democrats in a fear that it might work. Is that fear justified?
No, because people continue to feel like that whatever issue you're putting forward is going to cause this very fluid electorate to shift its allegiances back and forth. And that's not what's happening. And that does get to the fundamental point that led me to write the second book, is that we are still engaged in a fundamental battle in this country over, is this going to be primarily a white country or is it going to be a multiracial democracy? And that's largely how elections play themselves out. And so what the failure of Democrats and progressives is to define the race in those terms and to challenge and summon people to a higher level of standing unapologetically for the fact that this isn't a multiracial nation, or at least should be. And so Biden's Philadelphia speech was a good step in that direction. But that's the much more fundamental dynamic in elections rather than an ad that's tweaking this particular issue. Because crime is a whole is just a code word for people of color and attempt to scare white people. And so the extent that we don't understand that that's the underlying reality of almost all of these elections, our analysis and our strategies are not as effective as they could be.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
And so then the president and the Democratic Party and candidates around the country talking about MAGA Republicans, ultra MAGA Republicans is, if I heard your last answer right, is getting to that higher issue about the democracy and freedom and who we are as a nation.
Yes, in a lot of ways, it's probably, you know, Biden's, it's kind of that Nixon going to China thing. It's a person who can make that argument even more. I mean, Obama couldn't even say that a distinguished black professor shouldn't be arrested in his own house, right? What happened with Skip Gates, right? So they have that whole beer summit, and he had to backtrack of all of that. So a white president can do a more forceful job of challenging white people to rise to their highest and best selves. And hopefully the advisors and the pollsters around him would see that that is in fact a winning and a majority strategy. And that's really the fundamental struggle that we're engaged in, both writ large as well as within the progressive movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk more about your book, How We Win the Civil War. And what I find interesting about the title, Steve, is that it gives the impression that we're either currently in a new civil war or we're still fighting the one that ended in 1965, or am I over-interpreting this?
No, that's exactly the point. My fundamental point, the whole first half of the book, is an attempt to have people appreciate the ferocity of the fight we are currently in because it is a direct continuation of the original Civil War. And so the whole first half of the book is I'm trying to explain that the Confederates have never stopped fighting. They 5 days after supposedly surrendering at Appomattox, they shot the president in the back of the head and assassinated him. One day after John Wilkes Booth heard Lincoln's speech and said, that means N-word citizenship. That's the last speech he'll ever give. And so they have never stopped fighting from that point through overthrowing Reconstruction, reinstating legalized apartheid in this country all the way up to 1965, all the way up to storming the Capitol on January 6th, carrying the Confederate flag and wearing T-shirts saying MAGA Civil War. So when I say winning the Civil War, I mean the original one from 1860s, because the folks who waged that have not stopped fighting.
And so, you know, you open, the opening pages of your book are about January 6th. Take us back to that day and tell us how you were processing what was happening here in D.C. Because I remember Michael Steele and I, the former chair of the RNC, we were doing a virtual event with the John Adams Society based in Amsterdam. And we were both watching, and the folks in Amsterdam were watching too, in real time. Folks run up the steps of the Capitol, and we were all just sort of dumbfounded by what we were seeing.
Absolutely. And we shouldn't forget that January 6th, I mean, it's not stupid to say it, but it was the day after January 5th, which was the day where the literal heir to Martin Luther King Jr. was elected to the United States Senate. Raphael Warnock preaches from the pulpit where Dr. King preached. He was elected to the Senate, and the next day, people carrying the Confederate flag stormed the Capitol to say, we are not going to stand for this. We are not going to have our country be like this. So I titled the intro to my book, the introductory chapter, a choice between democracy and whiteness. And that's a line that Taylor Branch, a historian who wrote Parting the Waters, said to Isabel Isabel Wilkerson, as they were talking about the rise of white domestic terrorism within the country, and that how people were not going to stand for this diversification and the transformation that's not being a white country. And Taylor Branch posed the question, if people were given a choice between democracy and whiteness, how many would choose whiteness? And Wilkerson says, we let that hang in the air. Neither of us willing to hazard a guess as to that one. And so on January 6th, you had people literally trying to stop democracy. And what I talk about in the book, the examples of chanting racist phrases at the police officers there, as I was saying, carrying the Confederate flag, wearing Civil War t-shirts, all to keep in power this man who's one of the proudest pro-white nationalist presidents that we've ever had. So we had a chance to choose between democracy and whiteness, and a whole lot of people did choose whiteness, and a whole lot of people still want the man who was the personification of that to lead this nation and to lead this nation and a whole Make America White Again movement that he's been championing.
And, you know, we as a nation have been through these turbulent times before. I mean, a civil war was fought. You know, as you argue, it's still going on. But now we're in a situation, at least in recent memory and modern times and in present day, what you're talking about is not only being led and run by a former president of the United States and was being led by a president of the United States when he was in the Oval Office, but he's being aided and abetted by a lot of people who technically know better, but because they have their own personal or political goals, turn a blind eye or don't speak up and push back against this. Is there any way for the country to get past this moment, this very rough moment that we're in, without Republicans joining Democrats in their calls on leaders to pull the Republican Party and to pull the nation back from the brink?
Well, it that's the moment that we're in. And we talk about this country being at an inflection point, right? And that there are these, I forget who wrote this, I apologize for not saying, but a lot of the conservatives and like the Republican writers were saying that don't take Trump literally, but take him seriously. And then they were saying on January 6th, those who took him literally, those who took him seriously, collided in the halls of the Capitol as those who took him literally came to hang Mike Pence. And so the others went fleeing for their lives. So I just don't think fundamentally, and if you even look throughout history, that that's where and how change comes from. Change comes from the people who are bearing the brunt of the inequality and injustice, pushing to make society better and more just and more equal. Right. It wasn't, there were sympathetic and supportive white Southerners in Montgomery, Alabama, but they didn't lead the fight. It took Rosa Parks, Montgomery Improvement Association, and all of the organizers to organize a bus boycott that then others could support. And so it's a question of which comes first and what's the driving force. And that's one of the things that I talk about in my book. I say there's a liberation battle plan of the places that have actually transformed, Georgia and Arizona and Harris County, Texas, and Virginia and San Diego. And one of the core elements is that there is a strong leader there, and then there's also a strong civic engagement organization that can transform the composition of that electorate. So to the extent that we can really bring actual multiracial democracy and then govern in the interest that improves people's lives, that's going to be the driving force. And then hopefully some of the more, you know, open-minded Republicans will say, yeah, that's actually a good thing for us to pass the first climate change legislation in the history of this country.
Two questions in the little bit of time that we have left. One is more on this point. I've been making the argument that it doesn't matter whether Donald Trump runs for president in 2024. Trumpism is abroad in the land, and that you've got plenty of people who are, you know, Governor DeSantis in Florida, Governor Abbott in Texas, doing all sorts of things that are Trump-like, and yet they could run for president and could possibly win. How concerned should folks be that, or let me rephrase it, not how concerned folks should be. Talk about how mindful people should be that they don't need Donald Trump exactly. in order to carry out the policies that Donald Trump was trying to implement or was doing when he was president.
Exactly. And the other part of that is that Trump was not powerful and Trump was not popular until he started championing whiteness and attacking people of color. He was at 4% in the polls and among Republicans in May of 2015 until he started calling Mexicans rapists and murderers. And then he zoomed up in the polls and he took first place within a matter of weeks. And that's when he was all like, I could shoot somebody in Fifth Avenue and get away with it because he saw the power of whiteness. But he's not the first person to do that. And this has been the consistent theme. That's why I talk about the Civil War never ended, the modern day Confederates. George Wallace had a similar quote. He says, I used to talk about roads and bridges and schools and nobody listened. Then I started talking about the N-words and they stomped the floor. And this is what Trump has found. And then he went on to win 13% of the vote in the 1968 presidential election. So this movement to define this country as a white nation literally goes back to the Civil War. And it continues up to this day. And if it's not Trump, somebody else will be championing that fight in 2024 and beyond.
And George Wallace ran, got double-digit percentage support, as you just said, but didn't win. And what Trump was able to do was to ride that wave of resentment into the Oval Office. Last question, and it made me think of this as you were talking before. I'm wondering the role of abortion and the Dobbs decision in how we should be looking at the midterm elections, and also whether that upends or changes in some way your new majority index. Has it had any kind of impact? Because, you know, the Dobbs decision was an earthquake. Then the Kansas referendum vote was an earthquake. And we're seeing with voter registration numbers coming out of key states like Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania, the new registrants of women is going through the roof.
Right. But part of it's that saying about first they came for this group and I said nothing and then they came for me. Right. So this country was created quite explicitly and unapologetically as a straight white male Christian nation. And so anything who is not that has had to fight and struggle for equality. And then now we have these leaders who are trying to take us backwards in that direction. And so Dobbs is part of that reality around trying to move us back towards a country fundamentally for straight white male Christians. As Clarence Thomas previewed, he's coming for the LGBTQ communities next in terms of where they actually want to go. But what happened with Dobbs is they overstepped. And so they stepped over into, so I think, some of the women who may not be as clear necessarily on all of the racial dynamics and issues themselves, but then they were coming for them. And that's a different piece. And people have responded in ways that have been surprising to many people in politics. And Kansas is a great example. Kansas is not on the cutting edge of the revolution and the Rainbow Coalition in this country. But clearly there was a backlash there.
Steve Phillips, author of How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. Thank you so much for coming back to Capehart.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Capehart. It's produced by Nick Roberts. We'll have new episodes for you every Tuesday. I'm Jonathan Capehart. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.